Good evening. I add my words of appreciation to those that have already been spoken for the presence of everyone who is here tonight. Your presence is an encouragement to me. It's an encouragement to those who are around you, and I know that the Lord is pleased as well that you have decided, made the decision tonight to come and to be here with the people of God to worship God. If you would turn to Jeremiah chapter 38. Jeremiah chapter 38. Children of Israel at this juncture in their history are right on the cusp of going full-blown into Babylonian captivity, right on the cusp of the city of Jerusalem being destroyed and the temple itself being destroyed. Zedekiah is the king of Israel at this time. And he is not a righteous man. In Jeremiah chapter 38, in verse 2, this is Jeremiah speaking. Thus says the Lord, he who remains in this city shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. But he who goes over to the Chaldeans shall live. His life shall be as a prize to him, and he shall live. Thus says the Lord, this city shall surely be given to the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take it. Therefore the princes said to the king, please let this man be put to death, for thus he weakens the hands of the men of war who remain in this city, and the hands of all of the people by speaking such words to them. For this man does not seek the welfare of this people, but their harm. Then Zedekiah the king said, look, he is in your hand, for the king can do nothing against you. So they took Jeremiah and cast him into the dungeon of Malchiah, the king's son, which was in the court of the prison. And they let Jeremiah down with ropes, and in the dungeon there was no water but mire, so Jeremiah sank in the mire. Zedekiah is in a terrible predicament. He's really kind of between a rock and a hard place here. The forces, the army of the mightiest nation on earth is sweeping through his land, and they are coming upon the city of Jerusalem, evidently with the intention of destroying this city. Jewish culture said that what you do is you defend this city at all cost. The Jewish tradition was that this city could never be taken under any circumstances. And against that, then, there is Jeremiah, and his plea to the people is one of surrender. Give up. Open the gates to the Chaldeans and let them have the city, and place yourself under their control. Now, to say that Jeremiah's advice was unpopular is a huge understatement. And so the princes of Israel said to the king, we need to kill Jeremiah. And so Zedekiah said, well, you do with him whatever it is that you want to do. He couldn't go against the princes. And so they take Jeremiah and they threw him into a muddy cistern. The King James uses the word dungeon, and the New King James follows after that. My understanding is the Hebrew word is one that signifies a pit or a well or a cistern. Now this cistern does not have water in it. It has mud, sticky mud, mire in it. The reason they did this to Jeremiah is that they felt that his words were treasonous words. But what they didn't understand about what Jeremiah was advising them to do is that Jeremiah was not really advising them primarily to surrender to the Chaldean army. What he was advising them to do is to surrender to God. And it was God who was saying, open the gates. It was God who was saying, you need to surrender yourself to the will of the Babylonians. As if they did that, then they would be surrendering themselves to the will of God. They would be doing just exactly what God wanted them to do. Refusing the Babylonians would be a failure to surrender to God, and thus to surrender to the instrument of God's punishment of these people. The message of God has always been, you need to surrender. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, Adam and Eve are told what they are to do, that they are to tend the garden in which the Lord had put them, and they were to keep that garden. They had work that they were to do. But he also says to them in verse 17 that there was a certain tree that they could eat of, but there was a certain tree that they could not eat of. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they could not partake of. He was requiring that they submit to him, that they surrender to his will. And the serpent uses that in chapter 3, when the serpent comes to Eve there at the beginning of chapter 3 in the garden. His question to her is, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Is God shackling you? Is God making you submit to him? And he points out that there are trees that she can eat of. In fact, all of the other trees she can eat of, only of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the serpent's message to her in verse 4 is, you shall not surely die. Eve had told the serpent, the day we eat of it, the Lord said, the day we eat of it, we'll die. And he says, you shall not die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. The promise is that when you do what God said not to do, when you fail to surrender to God, you become like God. You become your own God. You become equal to God. You are as free as God is. And that's kind of what got the ball rolling with Eve. And so there in verse 6, she sees it. She likes it. She figures it'll taste good. It'll make her wise. She swallows the argument of the serpent and she partakes of it. She commits sin. But God's message to Adam and Eve that they did not heed was, you need to surrender yourself to me. That's the same message in Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. When Noah and his family come out of the ark, they're not coming out of the ark free to do whatever they want to do. The Lord has restrictions for them, and they must submit themselves to the will of God. The message of God to Noah is, surrender to me. Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, when God calls Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees and tells him to go to a place that I will show you, that is God's message to Abraham, you need to surrender to me. You need to surrender your life and go wherever it is that I lead you to go. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, that's the message of Moses to the children of Israel. There in these passages, he presents to them alternatives. You can either do what God says to do, or you cannot do what God says to do. And if you do what God says to do, there will be blessing. If you don't do what God says to do, there will be curse. The life will be hard. But notice there in Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 and 2, it says, now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all of His commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Moses says, you want God's blessings? You want God to be with you and take care of you? And he outlines all the blessings that God will give to the children of Israel. What it means to have for them to have a right relationship with God. And they're wonderful blessings. But Moses tells them that those blessings will come to them only as they surrender themselves to God and to God's will. Joshua gives the same instruction to Israel in Joshua chapter 24, verses 14 and 15, that famous passage of, "Choose you this day whom you will serve, whether it's the God of the lands or Jehovah God, but as for me and my house, I'm going to serve the Lord." And his point there in that passage is the same as Moses, his predecessor. You need to surrender yourself to God. The message of God to mankind has always been surrender. Serve me, submit to me. And so it is not surprising when we come to the New Testament that is the message of the gospel. In Romans chapter 6, verses 15 through 19, turn to that passage and you see the same kind of alternative there that Paul sets before us as Moses, as Joshua set before the children of Israel. And that is, either serve the gods of this world or serve Jehovah God. Listen to him in Romans chapter 6. Beginning at verse 15, "What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? Certainly not. Do you know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness." And he says there in verse 19, "I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness." That is the Apostle Paul saying to these Roman Christians, that just as you surrendered to Satan and to sin in your previous life, now that you have obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, you need to recognize that you have surrendered yourself to God and to His righteousness and to His holiness. The very heart of the gospel is surrendering ourselves to God, of obedience to His will, of submission to what He has said. You go over to Ephesians chapter 5 and you see that in all kinds of relationships. He talks about the family relationship there. In Ephesians 6 and verse 1, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for that's the right thing to do," he says. In chapter 5 and verse 22, "Wives are instructed to submit or surrender to their husbands." Husbands, in Ephesians 5, 25 through 27, are instructed to surrender to their wives. And you say, "What do you mean by that? I thought the husband had authority." Yes, he does. The husband has authority in the marriage relationship. But what he says there in verses 25 through 27 is that he has that authority so that he might serve his wife and make her better. He might do for her what Jesus did for the church, sacrifice himself. That's surrender. It is surrender with authority, but it is still surrender. And then in chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, he talks about bond servants and masters. The bond servant is to obey the will of the master, and the master is to recognize his responsibility before God to be fair to his bond servant. We would call it employees and employers today. And the point is that employers and employees both surrender themselves to one another. But really, and what we see throughout chapters 5 and 6, in this idea of submitting yourself, the wife submits herself. Really what she's doing is she's surrendering to God. When she surrenders to her husband, and it is because God, that is what God demands of her, she is surrendering herself to God. And the husband, when he treats the wife, as this passage says that he is to treat her, when he loves her sacrificially, he is surrendering himself to God. The child who obeys his parents in the Lord is surrendering his or herself to the Lord. He makes the point there with masters in verse 9 of chapter 6. And you masters, do the same things for them, that is, treat them fairly, giving up threatening, knowing your own master also is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. Recognize who you are surrendering to when you surrender to your master. And he says the same thing going up to verse 7 about the bondservant to the master. Know that when you are surrendering to your master, he says, you are doing it as to the Lord and not to men. And so the message of Ephesians 5 and 6 is surrender to one another because you have surrendered to God. And there in verse 21, he just applies it before he starts pointing out specific people. He applies it to everybody in the Lord's church. He says in verse 21, submitting to one another in the fear of God. Our responsibility is to surrender to the Lord. And when we surrender to the Lord, that will cause us to surrender, to submit ourselves to one another. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 17, the responsibility of the church to its elders is that the church is to obey its elders and submit themselves to the oversight of those elders, surrendering themselves. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 20, even our enemies. What Romans 12 says about our enemies is that we don't seek our own vengeance. We leave room for the vengeance of God. And if we see that our enemy is hungry, rather than kicking him when he's down, we give him something to eat. When we see that he is thirsty, rather than striving to the best of our ability to see that he stays thirsty, Paul says we give our enemy something to drink. What are we doing? We are surrendering to our enemies because we are surrendering to God, and that is the will of God. And so you and I, in James 4 and verse 7, James says, have the responsibility to submit to God, to surrender to Him. And that causes us really, when you think about it, to surrender to everybody else but the devil. He says, submit to God, but resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. In Luke chapter 9, verses 23 and 24, Jesus' message to the audience at that time is a message of surrender. In Luke chapter 9, verses 23 and 24, a passage that we're very familiar with, he said to them, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. Surrender. That's what Jesus says. Surrender yourself to God. Wherever that might take you, whatever it might cause you to have to do, whatever gates you have to open, whatever enemies that you have to allow to come in, if God says surrender to me, we surrender to Him. Our society is very much like the princes of Judah. Never before has our society trusted so much and the barriers that it has set up for itself. The women's movement says, don't surrender to anybody. That it is somehow degrading and inhuman when we surrender ourselves. And God says just the opposite. The way to victory, the way to ultimate victory, the way to ultimate honor, the way to ultimate glory, is through surrender. Men are encouraged to trust in themselves only, to not bend their will to anybody. Again, the gospel says just the opposite. We bend our will to God, and that causes us to bend our will to the welfare of others. Heaven forbid a parent try to force their will on a child in this society today. And the fact of the matter is, children have the responsibility to surrender to God, which leads them to surrender themselves to their parents. There's a movement in the church today to ignore the organization that God has given to the church, to rebel against the idea of the authority of elders. In all these situations, there's an attitude that is echoed by the princes there of Judah when they say, "This man does not seek the welfare of this people, but their own harm." We hear that all kinds of ways in this day and time. Surrender yourself? Well, that's harmful. Put others before yourself? That'll mess you up. That's the message that the princes gave to Zedekiah. We want to really mess ourselves up. We want to do ourselves much harm. Then listen to Jeremiah when he says surrender. Now as then, surrender is an unpopular message. Now as then, you will suffer if you shout it too loudly. And so what did they do? Well, they threw Jeremiah in a cistern. I don't know about you, but I can't imagine much worse that could happen than to be lowered down by ropes into a dark, dingy, mud-filled cistern. I've not been in a cistern before, but I can just imagine what kind of bugs are down at the bottom of that thing. I can just imagine what kind of reptiles might be slithering around in that mud. Jeremiah sunk into the mire, that sticky mud. And evidently, from Jeremiah 38 and verse 9, it was the intention of those who had placed him in that cistern that he stay there until he starved to death. Now imagine that kind of a death. He lowered down into a dark, muddy cistern. You're stuck there. You probably can't even move. And you just stay there. And no one comes to bring you food, no one comes to bring you water until you finally starve to death. There is a fate that's worse than death. And I would ask you, what if you were threatened with a muddy cistern? What would you do? Would you continue to shout the message and live the message of surrender to God? Or would you change your mind real quickly and do what everybody else was doing and say what everybody else was saying? In John chapter 15, verses 18 through 21, we find that the message of surrender that we must speak is not a popular message. There in John chapter 15, Jesus is preparing His apostles for the reception, the very unkind reception that they will receive when they go out with the message of the gospel. And what He wants them to know is that when He comes in, when these men come into these cities and they begin to preach the message of surrender, they can't expect to receive a key to the city and a ticker tape parade. He says, these people are going to hate you. And He says, that ought not to surprise you because they hate Me. You see, Jesus preached a message of surrender to God. Denial of self, taking up cross, and people didn't like that message. It wasn't a popular message in Jeremiah's time. And it's not a popular message in Jesus' time either. He says there in verse 18, if the world hates you, you know that it hated Me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word which I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. He says the primary problem with the world is they don't know God. And as a result of that, they don't understand Jesus Christ and his message of surrender. And as a result of that, he says, when you preach the same message, they're not going to understand your message either. They're going to hate you just as they hated me. And so in 1 John 3 and verse 13, John kind of applies that to us as well. Now, in John 15, Jesus is applying that to John and the other apostles. What John does in 1 John 3 and verse 13 is tell his audience of Christians that really applies to us all. Do not marvel, my brethren, if the world hates you, he says. And before the writing of the New Testament was completed, the world was showing its fangs against the people of God. It was showing how much it despised God's people by basically placing the people of God, or at least trying to the best of their ability, to place them in their own kinds of cisterns. James and 1 Peter and Revelation were written to Christians who found themselves in similar situations as Jeremiah found himself. They're going through trial. They're going through tribulation. They're going through trouble. They're going through their own kind of cisterns because they are standing for the truth, because their message is a message of surrender that the world doesn't like. But James says there in James 1, beginning in verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. He says, let that work. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. His encouragement to them is, you be patient through the trials that you must go through because of who you are and what you stand for, what you live for, and what you teach. The same thing in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. He says, in this you greatly rejoice, that is, in the salvation that they have in Christ Jesus and the promise of an inheritance in the life to come. He says, you understand that and you're rejoicing in that, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. What Peter says there is, as you are going through the trial, realize the benefit of the trial. And there are benefits to the trials that we all must go through. There's benefit to going and spending a little time in the world's cisterns as a result of what we are and what we teach and what we do. He says one of those is it proves the genuineness of our faith. You don't have to wonder whether your faith is genuine when the world has lowered you into its cistern and you remain faithful to the Lord and you come through that with your faith intact. And so James says, be patient. Peter says, realize the benefit of it. And Revelation 2 and verse 10 says, don't fear it, but be faithful through it, and you'll receive a crown of life. In Jeremiah chapter 38, verses 7 through 13, there's a man by the name of Ebed-Melech, and he is one of Zedekiah's officers. And he is evidently a righteous man, and he pleads with Zedekiah to allow him to go and rescue Jeremiah from the cistern that he has been placed in. And he says, if I don't do that, he is going to die. It is the prince's intention that he stay there till he dies. He persuades Zedekiah to allow him to do so. And we're told that Zedekiah has a secret meeting with Jeremiah. Zedekiah is much more afraid of his princes than he is of Almighty God. And so he has this secret meeting with Jeremiah, and he doesn't want his princes to know that he was seeking Jeremiah's counsel. But he asked Jeremiah, and he says, "Be straight with me. What are my options here?" Jeremiah lays out to him what will happen if he obeys and surrenders. What's going to happen to him if he does not obey and surrender? In Jeremiah 39, then the Chaldeans break into Jerusalem. Zedekiah had a choice to make. Was he going to bend his will to the will of God? Was he going to surrender to God and thus to the Chaldeans? Or was he not going to surrender to God and keep the gates closed to the Chaldeans? He kept the gates closed, and the Chaldeans bursted through. Zedekiah and his men escaped, but the Chaldeans pursued them and finally caught up with them near Jericho. And in chapter 39, Jeremiah records what then happened to Zedekiah the king. Jeremiah 39, beginning at verse 6, says, "Then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes in Riblah. The king of Babylon also killed all the nobles of Judah." Now get the picture of that. Here is Zedekiah, and he is in chains, and he is brought before King Nebuchadnezzar, and he must witness the death of his sons. And that is the last thing that he ever sees. Because verse 7, it says, "Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze fetters to carry him off to Babylon." You see, there are things that are worse than spending a little time in a muddy cistern. Jeremiah stood for truth, and he found himself in a literal quagmire as a result. But he was saved from that situation by the intercession of a friend. But I want you to notice the description of Zedekiah in Jeremiah 38 and verse 22. And this is Jeremiah telling Zedekiah, this is what's going to be your lot. This is what's going to happen to you if you don't surrender to God and thus to the Babylonians. He says in verse 21, "But if you refuse to surrender, this is the word that the Lord has shown to me. Now behold, all the women who are left in the king of Judah's house shall be surrendered to the king of Babylon's princes." That's Zedekiah's wives, his concubines. And they won't be his anymore. They belong to Babylon's princes. And he says, "And these women shall say," and listen to this, "your close friends have set upon you," that is, they have misled you. You've listened to the wrong people. They have told you things that are not true. You see, the princes, when Jeremiah was telling Zedekiah, "You need to open the gates and you need to surrender yourself," the princes were saying, "You don't ever surrender, because God's going to be with you. God's going to protect you. This city can never fall. And so you just hang in there and you fight the Babylonians, and the Egyptians are going to come and the Egyptians are going to help us, and we're going to run these Babylonians out of town." And so he says, "When the Babylonians take your wives, what your wives will say to you is your friends misled you. You followed the wrong advice." And he says, "And they prevailed against you." They talked you into doing something that you shouldn't have done. And now listen to this part. Your feet have sunk in the mire. And what happened to his friends? And they have turned away or deserted you. You see, Jeremiah went into a literal cistern of mire. His feet were literally struck, but he had a friend. And that friend saved him from that awful situation. What Jeremiah says is, your wives are going to tell you that you are in a cistern of mire of your own making, and don't look for anybody to save you from it. That's where you are going to stay. And so Zedekiah, sure enough, had to stay in the muck and the mire of a cistern that he had built for himself. And the point of all of that ought to be obvious. God saves the righteous and He destroys the wicked. The wicked have to pay for their rebellion against God, for their failure to surrender to God. And yet God rewards those who surrender to Him. And that's the point that the Hebrew writer is making as we close this lesson, beginning in verse 26 of Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10 and verse 26 says, "For if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries." What the Hebrew writer is saying is, if we want to be like Zedekiah and ignore the warnings of God and fail to surrender ourselves to God, knowing full well that we're failing to surrender ourselves to God, then we can look forward to a fate that's worse even than Zedekiah's. But then, in verse 32 beginning, he speaks to those who are faithful. Now the unfaithful have to look forward to the fearful prospect of an angry God who punishes them eternally for their rebellion. But what about the righteous there in verse 32? "But recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods." There were people who had become Christians, and what they received from the world as a result of surrendering themselves to God and to God's will and saying to others, "You need to surrender as well," they got a bucket load of persecution. They got a cistern of their own. He said, "They took your things. They put you through tribulation and trials. I'm sure in certain ways, probably greater even than Jeremiah had to face in the cistern. These people had faced this." And you look at that and you say, how terrible that is for the righteous. But then he adds, in the last part of verse 34, that they did this knowing, he says, "that you have a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven." And he encourages them, "Therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward." That is, you keep on keeping on. You have confidence in God no matter what you have to go through, no matter how many cisterns they drag you through. Understand that God is going to save you from those situations. That God will bring you out and give you a home in heaven. And he says, "Therefore do not cast away your confidence." Don't you give up on God, he says, "which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise." Verse 37, "Yet for a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. how the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. The Hebrew writer says there is where Jeremiah is. We'll go through the cistern. If that's where God leads us, that's where we will go. James says we will go rejoicing. Peter says we will go understanding the benefit of it. And John says in Revelation 2, we will go and go through it, even all the way to death, if that need be. The Hebrew writer says we do that knowing that we have an eternal inheritance, that God has given us a deliverer. God has given us a friend who will lead us to eternal life. What about you tonight? Do you find yourself kind of in Zedekiah's position where you're in a cistern, a sticky situation because of sin in your life? If you stay there, then you're going to wind up like Zedekiah. You're going to die there. But God's offered you a friend, Jesus Christ, who can lift you out of that cistern of sin and give you the hope of heaven, give you a place of honor in His home. What about you tonight? Do you want that? Jesus said how you can get it in Mark 16, verse 16. He who believes and is baptized will be saved, saved from sin, saved to eternity in heaven. Again there in Revelation 2 and verse 10, be faithful unto death and I'll give you the crown of life. Obey God. Keep obeying God. Be faithful to God and He'll give you the crown of life. Can we help you to do that tonight? If we can in any way, let us know how we can by coming forward right now while together we stand and sing.